My father used to read me stories from the ancient West when I was a little girl. I must admit, I always wanted to play the part of the mysterious stranger.
Space, the final frontier. These are the recordings of the podcast Gimme That Star Trek. Its ongoing mission, to explore all of Star Trek, to seek out new guests and new opinions, to boldly go where many have gone before.
Welcome to episode 63 of Gimme That Star Trek, a proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm your host, Siskoid, and today we're going to talk about Westerns. Yes, Star Trek was sold to investors by comparing it to Wagon Train, and we are going to talk about Westerns and space opera in general, but we're really going to focus our attention on Trek's actual Western spoofs over the years. And to help bring this topic to life, welcome a good friend of this network, the masked stranger only known as Captain Entropy.
Well, howdy, Siskoid.
When I mentioned this topic on social media, you raised your hand, Captain. Are you a Western fan?
I am indeed. In fact, if I remember right, I didn't just raise my hand. I told you I was your Huckleberry.
You referenced something that might be like my favorite Western of all time, you know, in terms of entertainment anyways.
Yeah.
So immediately I took you to the side and we made arrangements. So I'm a fan of Westerns as well, which some people might think is kind of surprising, you know, because it's the American Old West and I'm Canadian and based on other things that I like. But I think Westerns are just as, I mean, they're full of heroic tropes, just like comic books, just like a lot of the science fiction that we watch.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. In fact, Westerns were always one of the entertainment options that I had available when I was growing up. My dad grew up in the rural Midwest, and my mom grew up in the rural South. They both, as children on into adults, enjoyed Westerns, and by the time they met, they were both living in Nevada, so that worked out. I would say that Westerns may have influenced my dad's personality some, the way that superheroes and science fiction influenced mine. I think I liked them because there was always a sense of struggle that made the heroism seem more real. I mean, just surviving in the Old West was a struggle most of the time.
It can be very gritty. It can be super heroic. I mean, there are those types of older Westerns, but the more you explore the Western genre, the less those are prevalent. You know, the sort of TV cowboy with the, you know, with a red shirt or something. Lone Ranger, right? There's stuff like that is, because it was, some of it is for television, some of it for radio originally. Those ones may seem a little bit arch in a way, but then you can get down in the mud fairly quickly. I think my preference really is the anti-Western, where the ethics or the fantasy of Western tropes are examined or reversed, you know, like the tropes are sort of upended. Like I remember when Unforgiven came out and everyone was raving about that aspect of it as if it were novel. But once you get into Westerns, you'll find it goes back to the 40s or 50s at least. Well, you know, I'm thinking of movies like High Noon or 310 yep. to Yuma or Anthony Mann's collaborations with Jimmy Stewart, like Winchester 73, The Man from Laramie, you know, Naked Spur, that kind of stuff.
The Searchers.
It goes back quite a ways where we're True Grit, you know, we're examining the Western hero and saying, you know, we sort of idealized the Old West, but here's kind of the truth of it. And it gets grimier and grimier maybe as we go, as we re-examine the genre.
I mean, that's real, right? And we want to see reality reflected in art, even though it's escapism. So, I mean, maybe one of the ways we make it escapism is we make it the Old West in some, to us, fantasy environment, a situation that we never experienced. But the moral ambiguity and, you know, the daily struggle and, you know, and the characters who are a mix of good and bad, those are all real life, right?
Do you have a favorite subgenre within this?
You know, I will say, so Tombstone is also one of my favorites. And I would say probably the subgenre is, if there is such a thing, is the team of capable, funny, interesting characters that team up against the gang of bad guys. And that covers a broad swath in Westerns. But one of the ones homaged in one of the episodes we're going to talk about today is Rio Bravo. And that's probably my favorite classic Western. That's got the sheriff who's trying to do the right thing, doesn't know everything that's going on. The drunken deputy he's trying to pull out of a bottle to help him. The crotchety old guy, the tense prison scenes. It's a very classic Western, but it's just a classic story well done.
I will admit to you that I am not a big fan of John Wayne in particular. I'll give him True Grit and I'll give him The Misfits. You know, there are some, but usually I find his performance unbearable. Really? So that cuts out a lot of John Ford films for me. It's like, like when I think of like my favorite Westerns, they're not going to be those particular ones. I mean, I love a spaghetti Western. I love what the Italians did with it. You know, so you get a lot of great stuff. And I just watched Django, the original Django, minutes from recording. Okay. I was watching that movie. So that's maybe more the appeal for me. And I love Westerns that don't take place in the Old West per se, you know, like a Korean Western or a Japanese Western or in Australia or Canada or, you know, like a Northern, a Southern, you know, stuff like that. That's not exactly a Western.
Yeah.
But that uses those tropes. I love it when they sort of reinvented that way.
Okay, well, so normally nowadays when I hear somebody say that they don't enjoy John Wayne, it's really about his politics. So I'm interested in what you say, what you mean when you're talking about his performance. Was he too wooden or too much the same guy over and over?
I think that's part of it. Yes, apparently he was a politics aside. He was a terrible person, apparently. But outside of that, out of that context, I just think like that delivery that people imitate, I find that impossible to believe in. So like his screen persona is not one that I tap into much at all. So like I said, there's some like when it's a great film and sometimes his performance will be tuned differently in those films. But it's finding those. So sometimes I'll start watching a Western and John Wayne's in it. Okay. And already I had to build up sort of motivation to watch it. And then it starts and it's like, oh no, he's doing that voice. He's doing that swagger. Yeah. And I'm not taken back to that time. You know, okay. I'm immediately aware that this is John Wayne. And other actors, obviously, there's a difference between an actor and a movie star. You know, movie stars often play the same. They play themselves or their screen persona in most films. I get it. But it just happens to be a persona that I find really takes me out of the film.
Have you seen The Shootist?
I have not seen The Shootist.
Okay. The reason I mention it, and not to suggest something that sounds like it would be like nails on the chalkboard to you, but I think it would fall in the category of your John Wayne movies that are, number one, it's an anti-Western, and I think his performance is more subdued. And he's playing off of, you know, Ron Howard and Lauren Bacall, and so he's not the only thing to see in the movie.
I'll take that under advisement.
There are plenty of other options. And I mean, there are plenty of others that don't have John Wayne in them that I enjoy very much. Both versions of the Magnificent Seven, which was based on a Japanese Western of sorts, like you said. But the Howard Hawks movies, of which Rio Bravo was one, I like those better than John Ford. And for me, that partly does have to do with who John Ford was, because I know that he was kind of a jerk on the set. For the comic book fan listeners, I think he was the Mort Weisinger of directors. I have to get past that to watch the movie. So anyway, we don't have to talk about Westerns in general forever. I know this is a Star Trek show.
Well, okay, before we go any further, and since this is your first time on the show, you get to answer that short questionnaire that demonstrates the kind of Trek fan you are. There's no wrong kinds, but what kind? So the first question is, what does Trek mean to you? How did you become a fan of it?
I became a fan through syndication. And I remember one of my earliest memories, honestly, is living in base housing at Travis Air Force Base in California, Northern California, and watching Star Trek at the age of 6. And I still remember I can see scenes from the episode. At that time, I was also, you know, I was influenced by living on the Air Force Base and my dad being in the military. And I was watching $6 Million Man, which features, you know, Steve Austin, astronaut. And at the time, I wanted to be an astronaut. And it was all about my desire for adventure and the way that it was portrayed, both, you know, my impression of my father's work, but also, you know, the much more colorful version that I saw on television. Maybe that's the halfway point between Westerns and Star Trek. I mean, because it's definitely science fiction, but it's also got Lee Majors, who is a swaggering cowboy, you know, Big Valley actor.
It's all connected, you know, it's like, yeah. I think that's what our childhoods are like, watching. It's not like today when people can pick and choose. And I know a lot of kids just don't watch TV series at all, you know, they're watching like shorter videos and that kind of thing. And that's going to be their common culture when they're talking about it, you know, in 10, 20, 30, 40 years. But for us, it was like, well, that's we've got three channels. This is what we got. If that, you know, and everybody kind of has that same culture and all of that is like mixed in. You're watching that Western, you're watching that cop show, which I would say $6 Million Man was kind of a cop show. It's like they're mixing genres. Star Trek was originally kind of mixing some Western tropes in with science fiction, which was, you know, wasn't something exploited a lot on TV, science fiction at the time. But they're all mixing these things together, and you're watching a schedule of programming. And so you're waiting for that Star Trek, but you're watching other shows just because you're waiting for Star Trek, or you're already watching Star Trek. So the next show over, and we're exposed to different things. And I think maybe we can grow to love different genres as a result.
Absolutely. And these things do become like halfway houses or gateway drugs. But and I hope I don't violate any fire and water rules or get Ryan Daly after me if I mention Star Wars. When I was living in that house in California, it was the same time that movie came out, and my dad took me and my brother to see it. And he told me later he expected not to enjoy that movie at all because he wasn't a science fiction guy. But then there's a big bad guy dressed in black, and the hero's dressed in white, and kind of the shady hero who's dressed in white and dark colors, and a little bit of shades of Liberty Valance there. And he quickly got into it. And I think there were some Western tropes in that science fantasy.
Han Solo is definitely a cowboy. There's no getting around that. All right, but back to Trek. So that's how you got into it. And it's still a big part of your life today?
Yeah, I'm not a Trekkie or a Trekker on the order that you are.
Few are.
Yeah, exactly. So I can hold my own in a discussion with other nerds, and I'm well above the average man or woman on the street. And so, you know, seeing all the pre-Paramount television series, starting to become acquainted with the Paramount series, but just at the beginning of that, all the movies, have gotten into a few of the books. So yeah, Trek is fairly important in my life.
All right. So what's your favorite iteration of the show?
This might run counter to what I just said, because I think it's kind of a plebeian answer, but the original series. I enjoyed that Trek maybe because they were more cowboy about it. They were less concerned about official procedure than some of the later iterations. And, you know, the characters and the actors were very colorful. Unfortunately, the show didn't give the secondary characters enough of the spotlight most of the time. The show would have been richer if they had, but it was enjoyable anyway.
Always tough to beat your first one for a lot of people. Who's your favorite character?
That was a harder question because there are so many great characters. And and I love a lot of them, but some of the later characters I grew to love more as time went on, because they got to be more interesting. You know, Worf got to be more interesting. Riker got to be more interesting. Your namesake got to be more interesting as they developed the character. But we've had more time with the original series characters. So I'm a big fan of Simon Pegg's version of Montgomery Scott. I mean, all versions, but his particularly. I love every iteration of Spock because he always sees through the dilemma to find the right thing to do. And then he does it, and sometimes he even does it without orders. But today, for this Western episode, I will say my favorite is Bones. He is a Southern gentleman with a medical background who has wandered far from home, like Doc Holliday. He said things nobody else would say, and the Southernness of him, the kind of the folksy homespun way that he talks and reacts, reminds me of home. And he always saw through Spock when Spock was posturing.
Yeah, so he'll be Kirk's Huckleberry, is what we're saying. Okay, and I like that you're open to ask me a different day and it might be a different person. You know, it's like Trek is rich enough for that.
Absolutely.
Well, finally, What's your favorite alien race or culture in the Trek universe?
Well, it's going to be hard to get anything Western out of this, but probably the Romulans. All the Romulans that we were allowed to see in the television shows and movies seemed like more fully fleshed out characters than a lot of the other aliens. Even the Klingons early on were like kind of two-dimensional brutes in a lot of ways.
Yeah, space bullies.
Exactly. But the Romulans seemed like they were formidable bad guys like the Klingons, but there was more to them than that. If you think about the character, the commander in the Enterprise incident, or the captain from Balance of Terror that looked surprisingly like Spock's father, those were characters with some redeeming qualities, even though they were the bad guys. And my impression of their culture, and I'm not an expert, is that they very appropriately drew a lot on ancient Rome.
They sort of flipped them, the Klingons and the Romulans, when they went to TNG, or maybe even during the movie era. TNG is really where it turns, because suddenly the honorable Romulans are now treacherous to a fault. The Klingons, who were just treacherous, you know, in the original series, are suddenly the ones that have a code of honor. So, you know, they sort of flipped it because that was a more interesting thing. But the Klingons were by then more iconic than the Romulans, I think.
And you had a Klingon on the bridge. So, you know.
You needed to.
Yeah.
And even he was shown to be more honorable than the honorable ones. You know, it's like he was overcompensating given his position. Well, that's a very classic-minded Trek fan. That's good. That's fine. Well, let's get into the topic itself. Let's give me those Westerns. Let's talk about the general similarities between Westerns and Star Trek before we get into those particular episodes. So to you, does Star Trek actually feel like a... I know Roddenberry sold it that way, saying, well, it's wagon train to the stars. In other words, it's not going to be boring, stuck on a spaceship, except the third season. But what they're actually saying is week to week, we're going to be in a different place, like a different town, like, you know, like a traveling... whether a traveling cowboy or a traveling wagon, but we're going to meet different people at different places and have adventures just like Wagon Train, which was a show of the time. You know, that's how that was his elevator pitch. But to your mind, is Star Trek kind of a Western?
Yeah, I think it is. I mean, at least it's pulling heavily from Western tropes. Gene Roddenberry, maybe not the most reliable narrator and everything, but when he made that pitch Wagon Train to the Stars, I think he nailed it. I mean, he stayed true to that as he developed it, because it was a different setting and a different set of problems every week. More than that, you can even pick up some of the Western notes in the tagline and the opening narrative, because they are on the frontier. They go to planets on the edge of known space, and they're basically frontier towns. They really act like an idealized version of the U.S. Army cavalry in the Old West. They're carrying out the tasks they're given. They're trying to make peace. They're carrying sidearms in case they fail. You know, they're not conducting warfare against native peoples or anything. But like in classic Westerns, there's usually a clear good and a clear evil. In the more sophisticated Star Trek narratives, there's some moral ambiguity. But like you pointed out, that also matches the more sophisticated Westerns.
Like, I was questioning it because, well, Wagon Train to the Stars. Okay, we're moving from town to town, different problem. But when you look at, let's take another show, which is not a Western, but The Fugitive, which has been repeated in many shows, including The Incredible Hulk, most famously. But there are many versions of The Fugitive. The Fugitive is, yes, there must be somebody chasing our hero so that they have to move every week. But once they're there, there's Adventure of the Week, you know, supporting cast of the week, Adventure of the Week, Problems of the Week. It's just episodic television in a way. But in calling it a Western, it's like, well, does it need to be a Western? Is my question about that premise. But you're right that other similarities have cropped up. Maybe because the writers were aware of this elevator pitch. You know, it was in the series Bible. I think, like, once you get to TNG, the other inspiration comes more to the front, you know, like the Horatio Hornblower.
Yes.
You know, exploration of a captain. We get that with Kirk. Certainly Kirk is very conflicted, and that's what makes him such a great character in the series. But once you get like Picard doesn't feel like a cowboy, you know, or doesn't sound like a cowboy anyways.
No.
So here, Riker is our cowboy, I guess.
Yeah.
Okay, we're moving towards more of the Horatio Hornblower naval ships rather than the cowboy diplomacy. of the original series.
Cowboy diplomacy is also similar to gunboat diplomacy. So I don't think those tropes are too far apart.
No, just the setting. But then once we get to Deep Space Nine, though, I remember how it was described at the time. So its own series Bible had it as Sisko was described as a town sheriff. He walks into a new town, sheriff, called him maybe a mayor to give Odo, you know, his due. But it's a small town. It's got a saloon. And it's on the frontier. It's got, you know, it's like there's a war brewing with the other side. Maybe call that Mexico, call it whatever you want. With Deep Space Nine, they went back to describing it as a Western.
It's a stationary Western, like many Westerns are. So it takes out that question of, you know, does wagon train have to be a Western? You know, this could be a ship going from place to place just as easily, like a nautical ship. And the other thing you made me think of is that them playing with the nautical tropes and themes, Starfleet is modeled somewhat on the Navy. They've got Navy ranks, you know, they talk about things in ships. It's the USS Enterprise. So that was baked in from the beginning, but they started playing with it a lot more in the movies, and TNG just took off with it. Picard was an interesting guy because he wasn't a cowboy. He was trying to follow the rules, and sometimes the situation wouldn't let him. But he was very – I remember hearing something where somebody compared Kirk and Picard as their first reaction to a problem is Kirk is shields up and arm the photon cannons, and Picard was, let's have a meeting.
One of the things that Next Generation did was it became very, very popular, just as popular, if not more, than TOS in its day, you know.
Yeah.
But it also – it's kind of set a mold that then I feel like every other show of that era – tried to rebel against. So Deep Space Nine, much darker than TNG, stationary, and so on. Maybe like there's too much luxury on the Enterprise D. You know, it's about family. There's something soft about it in a way. And so when you're looking at Deep Space Nine, okay, we're going to put it on the frontier. We're right next to an evil empire. Half the staff is natives of this planet who are not part of the Federation. Let's do it that way. Voyager, not really a Western when you think about, but except they're way out on the frontier. There's another quadrant. That's still what they're trying to do. An Enterprise, okay, let's take it back to before TOS, when we don't have all the tools, when we don't know what we're doing, when we haven't met all these creatures and races. And now, again, this is the final frontier at the very beginning of it, you know, just stretching out from Earth. It's like every show after TNG went, okay, now the universe is a little bit too comfortable. Bring back the idea of the final frontier, of frontiers, which are innate to Westerns.
Yeah, and I think they're also bringing back a sense of menace to it, which the frontier is scary, right? You're on the edge of civilization, you don't know what's out there, and your ability to call on support is pretty limited. I mean, man, that's Voyager all over, is limited ability to call on support. I mean, and Voyager was interesting to me in that it brought in some of that moral ambiguity. And we look back on the Old West now like we do, you know, all kinds of things in history and debate whether or not people were right to do the things they did or just judge them and say they weren't. And, you know, people do that to Janeway all the time. I get frustrated by some of the decisions she made, but, you know, she was legitimately in a very difficult situation, just like people on the frontier are. So, yeah, I mean, people have always said Star Trek was much cleaner than a lot of other science fiction. But I agree, Star Trek, The Next Generation was really, that was the pinnacle of the clean and comfortable space travel show.
The carpeted spaceship. Yeah. I mean, even those characters went on to darker things, darker ships in movies, and then Star Trek Picard, etc. We promised to look at Western episodes, and there are three that are overtly Westerns. You can make a case for a couple others, but really, these are the Westerns. And there's the original series, Spectre of the Gun, TNG's A Fistful of Data's, and Enterprise's North Star. So we're going to look at each of these. We'll ask basically, how does it play as a Western? What is it, you know, what are our general thoughts on it? What are the references to classic Westerns, or what tropes are being used? And what does it tell us about Trek? Why use the Western in a show that's already Western-y? And what does that bring out, you know, in that particular, for that particular series, whatever it may be? The first one is Spectre of the Gun. So basically, Kirk and crew are tested by godlike aliens who force them to reenact the gunfight at the OK Corral. Is that synopsis good for you?
Sure.
Yeah, let's keep it simple. What do you think of this one?
Honestly, this one was probably the most visually interesting.
Oh, yeah.
And it was because they didn't have a lot of money, third season, and they were reusing sets from Western movies on a soundstage. You can see all of that, but it's still visually interesting because it's not a straight Western. It's these aliens' interpretations of the gunfight at the OK Corral as they've pulled these images from Kirk's imperfect memory. And he's probably got Western movies mixed in with what he learned from actual history. So what's around them, you know, it's a movie set with a weird red sky and it's a Western fever dream. I enjoyed that aspect of it. And it's got plenty of tropes and we can list them. But the fact that it was coming out of Kirk's head, there were things that were historical inaccuracies, like Morgan Earp trying to have a relationship with Sylvia when, you know, his wife was actually in town at that point and it wasn't that big a town. Doc Holliday practicing dentistry in Tombstone. I can't confirm that that didn't happen, but I don't think he was practicing much dentistry by that point. I think it was mostly gambling and gunfighting. Mm-hmm. But all of that is okay because of the way they set up the plot.
I mean, in a way, it's interesting that you say that. That it comes from Kirk's head, yes. And that it's mangled. Like, he sees it as a legend more than historical fact. Because Spock, somehow, knows all the details. Like, the actual historical data about the OK Corral event. So, that's odd for Spock, perhaps. But he's got an eidetic memory, so if he's read it sometime, you know, he knows it. He's like the voice of history, whereas Kirk, yeah, it does come from movies and from legends and the way it is told and that idealized version. In a way, in this, they keep denying the Western. They keep trying to find a non-Western solution.
Yeah.
But it does fit the theme, you know, that this is no longer who we are is the theme of this. So they're relating, like, this is part of American history, and we're the future of American history or world history. Look how far we've come, which is part of, you know, Roddenberry's message. And that's what he's, like, by contrasting the Old West, that's kind of what they're doing.
And you see that at the end, his refusal to kill the bad guy, even though he's pretty sure this is all fantasy land anyway, he still decides to beat the guy up instead of shooting him, which he's rewarded for because this is maybe not non-violence, but minimal violence is one of the things that Star Trek's trying to preach, right?
Right.
It revealed a lot of the Star Trek ethos and the Enterprise ethos. The gas grenade was a perfect example of them trying to science or MacGyver their way out of a problem in a very non-Western way, but a very Star Trek way. And then it doesn't work. And that becomes their scientific solution because it proves to them that this should have worked. So this isn't a real environment.
Right. And they still manage a very Trek solution where they're basically hypnotized by Spock to not feel the bullets. That scene, that is gorgeous. I mean, that scene where it's like everything's blowing up behind them as if the bullets are going through them. And the ERPs are essentially something out of Westworld. Like these menacing black figures, devoid of emotion, really. So that's not part of the story. Like, this is a reversal, really, because normally we would follow the ERPs. The ERPs would be the good guys and the Clantons would be the bad guys, you know, and generally. So having the crew be forced to have the doomed positions of the Clantons, essentially saying, well, this is what the aliens think of us. We're the bad guys.
Absolutely. And on that note, before I forget, DeForest Kelly, this is his third trip to the OK Corral.
Yeah.
You saw that too?
Yeah, yeah. He's played a number of characters. I mean, he was not a Western star per se. He played a lot of heavies in Westerns.
Played Ike Clanton in a TV history show, and he had played Morgan Earp in the original 1957 movie, The Gunfight at the OK Corral.
DeForest Kelly isn't the only one either, you know, who's in this episode who's done Westerns. All these actors had to do Westerns at that time. So this episode, let's talk about the references per se, since we're already getting into it. So what are the references? Originally, this episode was supposed to be called The Last Gunfight. Obviously, it's about the gunfight at the OK Corral. It aired only one day before the 87th anniversary of the original gunfight at the OK Corral.
Oh, I didn't know that. That's interesting.
It's accidental, obviously. The Western as pseudo-historical legend. So to me, this is what this is in terms of big general trope, is that a lot of Westerns, including one of our favorites, Tombstone, uses real people from history, real outlaws, real lawmen, etc. But then once we get into the movie or the TV show, some of the details are like maybe iffy.
It uses a lot of the same tropes, like we've said, the saloon girl who's in love with the bad boy. The saloon itself is straight out of almost any Western movie. The showdown that happens in the jail, really not a showdown, but a face-off, that shows up in lots of Westerns and shows up again in another one of these episodes. They're relying on all this, but there's that surreal element of it, of, you know, they know this isn't the real Old West. And everything's just a little bit bizarre, and it made the whole thing much more interesting.
I agree. Of the three we're covering today, I think this is the best one.
Yep.
I mean, it's got its flaws, but I still think it's the one that works the best in terms of tension and visuals. I mean, it's overtly deconstructing the Old West. It's right there in the set design. You know,
it's falling apart.
We're just showing how little, and I've actually written a short story in the Western genre, sort of, that I've shared with people in the past called Hats. But in any case, in that story, it's all about, and I wasn't even thinking of this episode, but, you know, it's back in my head, right? And it's how little do you need to understand that you are in a certain genre? So here it's just like the facades. In my story, the facades disappear and you're eventually left with a white hat and a black hat floating. And you still know that that's what's going on. Yeah. That was the idea. How far can we deconstruct something? And I think Trek is, I mean, yes, there was for economic concerns, but at the same time, it's still visually gorgeous to do that. Like it's a stroke of genius to set it up that way, to light it that way. You know, it's like, look at the script. What can we afford? No, but we can make this a strength of the episode.
It's like the story about Steven Spielberg and Jaws, right? They couldn't make the robot shark work. So the whole movie came to be about suspense and not more than it was about shark attacks.
Right. And that's what makes it good, you know? Yeah. So we get a lot of this in here. I think one of the key pieces of the puzzle in terms of inspiration here has to be Hour of the Gun.
Okay.
It's a film by John Sturges. It's got James Gardner, Jason Robards. It's an OK Corral movie, and it has a very similar, and you can check that out on YouTube, just that scene, I think, but there's a very similar walking towards the Clantons moment. And this movie came out a year before this episode.
Oh, I missed that when I was doing my research. But James Garner, love him. And Jason Robards, he's either a scary bad guy or a scary good guy in every movie.
So what does this tell us about Trek? What is revealed in this?
Well, we already talked about the ethos. It's definitely reveals that. It reveals their dependence upon science and technology and the idea that they're going to science their way out of this. It's also the whole plot setup, more than this is a Western movie of Western tropes, or TV episode of Western tropes. The frame around it is a very Star Trek trope, and that is the super powerful, mysterious aliens are putting us to a moral test. And I don't know how many times they did that, but it even stretched into other iterations of Star Trek, right?
All right, well, Q is basically that character, right? And that took us for a while. I mean, one of the things that Star Trek is about is humanity examining itself. We go out there, but we find ourselves. The fact that Kirk, he's tried, it's a little bit like Q's trial, you know? He's tried, not for anything he's done, but for what his family... Because he says, like, my ancestors were on the frontier. So his family is being tried. His species history is what's on trial. And similarly, can we, I mean, like, say we're in the 60s or even if we're today, I mean, maybe especially for today, can we become the humanity of the show that has outgrown these old instincts, all the things that make the Federation a utopia? Are hard to believe in the world that we lived in the 60s or through to today. It's like, how are we going to get there, you know? And so this is kind of every time the godlike aliens are asking us to prove our worthiness, it's kind of that question that Roddenberry and then the people that followed are asking. Trek is about overcoming hardships, not just out there, but in here, inside us. And Kirk's ability to do that, to convince the Melkoshians, that's what the episode is kind of about. We live in the specter of the gun. We live in its shadow, if you will. So our countries, plural, our violent roots, like the world's violent roots. And then when they show us Star Trek, it's like, well, have we moved past all of that? Not entirely. So what a punch Wyatt Earp. But you know, there's a marked difference. And so it's aspirational in that way.
You'll probably remember the episode that I'm forgetting the name of right now, where Kirk makes an impassioned speech that is sometimes parodied about how we can choose not to kill today. He's making that to these aliens who have computers that set up or are set up to run a war game, and the war game itself does the killing for them.
Yeah, it's A Taste of Armageddon is the title you're looking for.
Thank you. It was going to bug me until you saved me.
That's my only talent, so I use it to help people.
I don't think that's true, but I'll move on for the sake of the episode. In that speech, what he's really saying to me was, they haven't moved on. They're still us. They're at a later stage in their recovery to the addiction. They're still addicts, but you know, they've got their 10-year chip now, if that makes sense.
Sure, yeah. I mean, it's a process. It's not, we're never going to be rid of violence. You know, everything wrong with humanity, that's not going to go away. A lot of it is ingrained, but we can strive, and we should. We shouldn't see it as a battle that's already lost. That's what, you know, Kirk and his crew are definitely holding that banner.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. Wanted to say, when you're talking about deconstructing and to where the story reduces to nothing but a white hat and a black hat, when we run military exercises, which my very first job in the Air Force was supporting a joint training exercise, I thought a lot about Western sets and movie sets in general, but especially Westerns, because that's what you always saw, right? Whenever they showed the back lot of Warner Brothers or whatever, these facades that had nothing behind them. And we very much tried to follow that philosophy of, we need to show the participant in the exercise, the player, what they need for the training to seem real. But we don't need to put any additional effort to make anything beyond what they see, because that's a waste of resources and time.
And that's what Spectre of the Gun did.
Yeah.
All right. A Fistful of Datas. So here we're going more for the spoof. A holodeck malfunction turns all the characters in Worf's Ancient West program into dangerous versions of Data. How does this one play as a Western for you?
It is a holodeck story based on classic Westerns, and I would say not even sophisticated classic Westerns, right? It's really about high-tech LARPing gone wrong. I mean, you know, and that's what all the holodeck stories are. But because of that setup, it's packed wall-to-wall with Western tropes. The sheriff, the saloon, the love-struck saloon girl, the piano player, the young wastrel villain, the rich daddy villain, the mysterious stranger. This is kind of a dumbed-down Rio Bravo. And it replays some of those same tropes from Spectre of the Gun. I mean, it's charming because it's showing you all these things very self-consciously, dressing Data up as a saloon girl, and you get to see Worf be uncomfortable. Counselor Troy as Durango, the mysterious stranger. So, I mean, who looks great in the outfit. It's entertaining, but it's definitely more lighthearted than the other episodes.
Right. And there's a lot of stuff going on the ship where the real Data is kind of acting or talking like he's in a Western. It's very thin in terms of what's going on in the holodeck itself. But you're right, Troy has, I think, never looked so cool, been so cool as in this episode. And I wish there was more of that. Like, to me, Marina Sirtis is extremely funny in her personal appearances as herself. But Troy was almost never allowed any kind of humor, you know? So this is one rare occurrence. I think she's very funny, like in First Contact in the movies. But this is a shining moment for her. And it's not even a Troy-centric episode. You know, earlier we had, it's all coming out of Kirk's head, and it's partial. And in this case, it's coming out of Alexander's head. I mean, we can sort of say, okay, we forgive the fact, you know, if it's in Deadwood, they say it's in Deadwood, which is in South Dakota normally. In this case, it looks like it's in Arizona or something.
Yeah.
The real Deadwood is, you know, at the foot of a small mountain range.
Yep.
You know, Black Hills. And the sheriff's office has a map of the Arizona territory. So, okay, this is a fake Deadwood that apparently is in Arizona. You know, Alexander is a kid. He's just inputting different things. And then apparently Barkley put in some of the sex and violence. We're getting a very much a spoof of the Western.
Again, you have a reason why it doesn't have to be real, right? Because it is a spoof, and it's basically, it's almost a tongue-in-cheek role-playing game of the Western. And as that, it's great. It's just when they decide that, okay, the glitch with Data and his connection to the ship is causing these malfunctions and the safety protocols are off. And each of these characters that Data is unintentionally taking over are going to have his abilities. On paper, that's really threatening. You would not want a strong, smart, fast android coming after you, right? But they've made the environment so cheesy that it was still hard to get that sense of menace. And then Worf, you know, they have the face off in the jail, and Worf gets shot, and still all he does is chase this guy out. Like he's still trying to figure out the rules of the genre.
You know, it feels like it could have been much more dramatic than that. You know, I'm thinking of maybe, you know, the Deep Space Nine episode where the holodeck malfunction is a James Bond spoof.
Yeah.
Like in that, there is a sense of danger because if you die on the holodeck, you know, if the character dies, you would actually kill the person that is incarnating them at that point, etc. Mm-hmm. So, and there seems to be real danger. In this case, you know, Worf starts out much too invulnerable. You know, he beats up the bad guy within seconds, and Alexander has to reset the game and yep. up the difficulty. So it feels like that all the way through, where it was never really enough of a challenge for Worf.
The gag of turning more and more characters into Data, which was supposed to make it a threat, they were also using it as comic relief.
Right.
And so it was hard, you know, you're mixing those two reactions and it really diluted the threat.
An iconic episode, we all remember it, very memorable. But maybe if, you know, when you rewatch, it's like, yeah, it is what it is. But let's look at the references to classic Westerns. Like the first reference is one that didn't make it on screen because the original title for the episode, the title is A Fistful of Dollars,
right.
A Fistful of Datas, right? We get it. It was originally The Good, the Bad, and the Klingon. So a different Leone film.
Yeah.
I mean, in the first scene of this episode, we have Picard playing the flute, and he actually plays a few notes from the theme of The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. Maybe they changed the name of the episode after that was decided or scripted or produced. I don't know.
Or maybe they just kept that in because it's a recognizable theme.
I will say, to start with, The Ancient West. I hate that. I hate that so much. That's the worst part of the episode for me. That we, like, you know, in 300, 200, 300 years, we're going to stop calling it the Old West and we're going to start calling it the Ancient West. Is there an Old West that is like today is the Old West and then there's an Ancient West? I think that's just the kind of science fiction gobbledygook that just didn't work for me.
Yeah, I mean, I get that they're trying to show that it's more removed to them than it is to us. For that change in language to occur, there would have been, had to have been something to replace the Old West. And kind of like World War I was the Great War until World War II happened, and now it's World War I.
So when does the new Old West happen so that the Old West has to be rebranded? I don't see it happening. It doesn't make any sense.
Maybe it's after the war that we're supposed to be in right now.
Right. Yeah, the Third World War. And then that's going to reboot an Old West. I don't know. It just, it doesn't quite fit with the Enterprise timeline either. So I call fooey on this one.
Okay.
But how about some of those other movie references? What did you catch?
So I already talked about the fact that the plot is an homage to Rio Bravo.
Someone gets jailed. There's a conflict because of it. That's part of Rio Bravo, isn't it?
The rich daddy. And what's really funny is that Marina Sirtis is actually playing the Ricky Nelson part. She doesn't sing, though, which is unfortunate. Yeah. But the saloon girl that's in love, but in this case with the lawman, it's in a lot of classic Westerns, including Angel and the Bad Man, which is an old John Wayne movie, although he doesn't end up with the saloon girl. He ends up with the nice Quaker girl. But it's probably most famous from the TV Western Gunsmoke and, you know, Miss Kitty. So Alexander getting kidnapped could be a reference to Big Jake, where, again, John Wayne's grandson gets kidnapped. But it's also more of a reference to Ransom of Red Chief, which is not a Western movie originally, but a short story by O. Henry. I read that there was a scene that was cut out where I guess Alexander was going to do some very Ransom of Red Chief style mischief. I regret that they cut that. I think that would have added to the entertainment.
Yeah, and you could have removed some of the Enterprise-centric scenes and made this more of a Western as a result.
Yeah, and I think they were trying to show us day in the life. This is what our characters do in their downtime. when they have time to kill. I generally appreciate those, but I agree with you. I think they overplayed it.
I think one of the other major influences is probably Shane, right? There's a moment referenced specifically when Alexander looks out the bottom of the saloon doors at his dad fighting.
Yes.
And there's like a very similar, famously similar shot in Shane, or the kid and the dog. And the Shane villain, I mean, a missed opportunity, because the villain in Shane is called Riker.
Oh, yeah.
They didn't do anything with that here. But there's the young son with the hero worship and the family clan terrorizing the town, the reluctant hero. That's all in Shane. Between that and Rio Bravo, you've got the DNA of this episode.
And I think Jonathan Frakes could have been a lot scarier. I mean, then, you know, so I'm just imagining, now that you said that, I'm imagining a different episode now.
A Fistful of Rikers.
You know, and you still could have made it be something that happened with Data being connected to the Enterprise.
Like, he turns the characters into people he knows from his memory. So you've got a Riker, you can have the different, you know, the different Trek actors can actually play the Western, not just Worf and Data and Troy.
Now I want to go warp 10 and go back in time and fix this episode. So because I mean, Jack Palance is the big bad in Shane, right? And he's just much scarier dude. And I think that would have really helped this.
I would be scared of Jack Palance.
Oh yeah,
in life. You know?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and I also want to call out Durango. Okay, the character that Troy is playing.
Yeah.
Is a number of references. First of all, in the whole Django exploitation that came out of that original Django film, where they dubbed and renamed, retitled a lot of movies that already, you know, they put Django in different movies, even though he wasn't necessarily in the movie in the first place. They just dubbed his name in or stuff like that. But sometimes they would do these ripoff Djangos who were called something close to Django. And one of these is Durango, who got at least one film. So the name comes from that. Mysterious stranger comes into town, man with no name. She's kind of that character. But also, I was quite taken when I saw a movie a couple years ago called Cat Ballou.
Yeah.
Jane Fonda.
Lee Marvin.
Yeah. Comedy Western. Yeah. And Cat Ballou and Troy Durango are styled very similarly, I felt.
Yeah, I agree. And the mysterious stranger trope probably goes back to, like, so one of the things that's interesting about the Old West is that it's like gangster movies in the 1930s, in that the genre was being built as people were writing stories about it. So, you know, there were tropes already as it was happening. And I think the mysterious stranger probably goes all the way back to that time, because it's been so used. And you know, frequently the mysterious stranger is the protagonist, but there's also the evil mysterious stranger, who is like, you know, Lee Van Cleef in The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, Angel Eyes. Troy really got the best part in this. And yeah, definitely a reference to Django ripoff. Even that was a reference to other things. So this is just homage built on homage.
And the final reference, of course, has to be, I think that's the best part of the episode in a way, is the Enterprise riding into the sunset at the end. So that was a great final shot that we never see, because this was supposed to be very much the Western. Looky Luke, you know, riding into the sunset, this time flying into the sunset. So that's a great way to end the episode. What does this tell us about Trek or Trek TNG?
It showed us a lot of character moments. You got to see humor from Troy, like you said. You got to see Worf's lack of familiarity with human history and Earth history, which kind of makes sense. I mean, he was raised by a human couple, but that didn't mean he necessarily had to take an interest in it, right? And it's a nice contrast with Troy, who learned so much about it, and, you know, and Spock, who learned so much about it, even though they have mixed heritage. So that was interesting. The Picard moments where he's trying to, you know, he's just trying to play music quietly in his room and master this piece, and people are constantly coming to him because he's the captain. It was almost too obvious for comedy, but it's realistic, so you get to see what the life of the captain is like. I'm not sure what else it told us about Trek. Oh, except that their trust for technology is amazing, because Geordi, the engineer, says, we're going to run this little test, shouldn't be a problem, everything's going to be fine, and give us some backup capabilities with Data. It almost gets people killed in the holodeck, which is a place where they literally play, and they're supposed to play safely. You know, and by the end of it, okay, everything's fixed, they're fine. The same engineer has said he's fixed it, won't be a problem. Their risk tolerance when it comes to technology is impressive, but I guess that's part of the culture of that time.
Has to be. I mean, this, the TNG era, if you're going to use a Western in it, it doesn't have the same resonance as with TOS. TOS was, like we said, frontier. It felt closer to the Western than this show does. So here, well, they still put the more hot-tempered Worf in it. So he goes through a similar arc as Captain Kirk. He refuses to kill at the end, or I mean, he couldn't kill an android, nor is this reality. You know, so the point is muffled, but it's kind of a similar moment. But I think it's more part of TNG's essential theme of family, with Worf having fun with Alexander, even though he dreaded it. Alexander programmed it, so the villains have a father who would do anything for his son. And then so that's like, that's the father he wants in a way. Troi is there to help. She's the surrogate mother in this, you know, she's counselor to Worf, but it's very often with the Alexander material, she's kind of been the surrogate mother. So there's a family union going on. And Data symbolizes work. He doesn't need to rest. In the episode, he tries to take over the functions of the Enterprise computer itself. He becomes the place of work, if you will, in a way.
Yep.
So Worf has to achieve work-life balance, which Picard and Data fail to in their subplots. You know, so whereas we see Riker and Crusher, they are achieving it. You know, they're using their downtime for recreation hobbies, artistic pursuits. Picard tries but fails, you know. So I think that's, there's a theme going around in there that the Western is used to create this, a conflict between two ideas, family, recreation, and then work, which is represented by the machine Data.
I would buy that. I think that the themes you're talking about are well represented. You've mentioned a couple times that TNG was about being a family show, and that hit on something with me. This didn't feel like Star Trek, like a Star Trek adventure drama, as much as it felt like a family drama where something dangerous happens. You know, where one of the kids might get hurt.
It often happens. I mean, there are some, obviously TNG has done, I mean, over 7 years, they've done different types of stories, but a lot of them are about, oh, there's this kid on the Enterprise who has like a trauma. Somebody's mom or dad crashes the party and there's like some soap opera to resolve. You know, there's a lot of that in TNG. All right, let's talk about North Star. In this Enterprise episode, Archer and the crew discover a 19th century era human settlement in the Delphic Expanse. So this is part of the big Zindi arc in the third year. So what did you think of this one?
As a Western specifically, I thought it was a fine story and it had some really excellent points. I think it was the least Western. And what I mean is it was making much more of an effort to portray the West as it was, or at least the people who came from the West, what that culture was, than it was trying to portray the Western in fiction the way the other two were.
Okay, yeah. But in that sense, it's kind of like a modern Western. That's what it looked like, you know? It's like the hats and the grime and the dirt. And it looks like a lot of Westerns that were made after the 90s. In that sense, visually, I mean, they had like that bleached out look as well. That was quite different from what was happening on the ship, which we don't see for the first 25 minutes. So it feels more like that visually they're trying to go with the modern Western. But then, of course, there's a Star Trek idea that comes in where these humans are living side by side with these aliens who their ancestors brought them here. And like a lot of those planets where aliens brought human cultures over so that they continue to exist and can be visited by our crews. That happens quite a lot. Yeah. In this case, these aliens are now being oppressed for the crimes of their ancestors. And there's a lot of prejudice and so on. And Archer kind of finds a balance, or tries to achieve a balance between the two sides. But humanity, stuck at the Old West level, you know, they're extremely violent and prejudiced, and it's a tough go. So that's the story, basically. One of the tropes that we get, instead of the saloon girl, we get the school teacher.
The school marm.
Yes.
Yes.
I mean, that's a twist on the other Star Treks, but it's also pretty common in Westerns.
Yeah, absolutely. There just weren't as many tropes in this one. Again, because I felt like they were trying to portray a more realistic Old West. And like you say, it was, I mean, it also matches up with a more modern Western. But you know, they had the tense moment in the saloon with the bad guy. You have, you know, there are plenty of Westerns with a crooked sheriff. This one has a crooked deputy and a sheriff who's morally questionable, but at least willing to listen, might be able to admit he's wrong. it was very serious. Essentially, the racism against these aliens and holding a grudge against them for what their ancestors did, which is there are plenty of societies on Earth that to this day still do that to other people or to minorities within their own societies. That was just all very real. There wasn't a lot of science fiction in it. There wasn't a lot of Star Trek until the very end. It was just these people that, you know, in a very delicate situation, they've been literally abducted by aliens, or their ancestors were. They fought off their slavers and trying to unravel that knot. So it was at least an interesting problem.
Yes. The dilemma was Star Trek. It's just like the science fiction tropes where even the aliens... It could have just been people who were like scarred from the plague or something, you know. The alien makeup was very minimal, and they're trying to make us care for these characters, I guess, and not create that wall between us and what is alien. I don't know. I think the episode would have worked better if they looked really alien, and you'd have that strange, kind of surreal thing that we get with the other Western treks, which is, you know, there's like, we recognize the setting, we recognize some of the characters, but also there's like this alien or surreal, or, you know, Data's walking around or as other characters. We get an element that is purely Trek in there, part of the setting. We don't get a lot of that here. It's very minimalistic. Right, the title North Star, I think, may have been a reference to the celestial signpost for slaves seeking to escape their condition in the antebellum South. I mean, that's where the title comes in, but it also sounds like Brave Star, or just like the Sheriff Star, that kind of idea that comes from Westerns as well. So it's evocative, but also it was grounded into something else, which in this case, humanity were the slaves of these aliens' ancestors. So that's the connection there with the title. But it's interesting what you say, because it's like, is there a line between what we would call a Western, which is a genre, and a historical film, which could happen in the Western United States in the 19th century, and we would not necessarily call it a Western?
That question is the one that I was kind of pondering when I watched this show, because I don't get the same feeling watching it that I do when I watch a Western. There were a few tropes in there, like we said, but there were a lot of things I just didn't recognize. And you're right. I mean, the plot itself and the dilemma is Star Trek, but the crux of the movie to me, or the episode to me, is when Archer is talking to the sheriff and is dropping the veil, right? I mean, he's letting him know, hey, I'm from Earth. Here's what's really going on. That's what everything hinges on, is how is he going to take this? And that's the moment of, to me, the greatest tension, even more than the fight. Mm-hmm. And it's handled masterfully. I mean, not just like in a storytelling way, but I mean, in story, Archer does a great job. And they portray this sheriff well as being, like, they paint him as a character who clearly has some flaws, but probably would listen, you know? It was a great story, but it was not a Western story to me.
Well, even that fight, which would be, the gunfight would be the Western trope, the Western thing. And it's done on a set that is very familiar as well. That's Six Point, Texas. It was used, I think it's the set that has been the most on screen in movies than any other in the world.
Oh wow!
I think it goes back to like 1940. it was built for my little chickadee, and, you know, kept up all these years. And every time they need a Western town, they use that. We've seen it before, and I mean, there's like the moment where he shoots they're using phaser pistols, and he shoots, you know, the balcony up top, and then the guy falls through the floor, and we've seen stuff like that in Westerns. But to me, that whole fight, it's sluggish. I mean, I've seen a lot of Westerns. Obviously, you can't compare television too much to movies just because of the time that they have to set up these things. So it's like they're doing the Western gunfight, but it's a little slow. It's a little boring. It's a little, we've seen it all before. So I was disappointed with the Western tropes generally. I liked the confrontation between the irredeemable deputy and Archer in the bar.
Yep.
Like, I like the tension there. I like the look of it. I like, you know, and that guy that kind of looks like Jeffrey Combs, but isn't that actor, is doing a good job of being really slimy.
Creepy.
And Archer, Scott Bakula, looks great in the Western gear.
Yeah.
So I like that scene, but then we sort of stray from the point that I would agree that this could have been any planet. It didn't have to be a Western. So I would agree with your assessment. Did you catch any real references to classic Westerns in this?
The very beginning when they're about to hang him, hang the Skagaran. And by the way, I agree with you. I remember I was rewatching part of it just, you know, just a little bit prior to recording. And the opening scene, I had to look, it's like, wait a minute, I thought that was a Skagaran. That guy looks really human. And you had to look really close to see that he was alien. And that was, it would have been handier just as a storytelling device to make them look a little more different from humans. But anyway, that scene is, I think, from Hang 'Em High. You know, the old Clint Eastwood, back, you know, back to the Sergio Leone, but the, I'm sure it's in a dozen Westerns. I think there was something like it in maybe in Silverado, if memory serves. But what you want to have happen is the, you know, the rope shot in two above the guy's head or something to rescue him. And it doesn't happen. And then you have, you know, the other old visual of the dead guy in the open casket leaned up against the wall, which we saw in Tombstone and we've seen in, you know, multiple other Westerns.
Yeah, we do get that. Well, the bartender's ancestor that's in a frame above the wall and who they talk about a lot, Cooper Smith, that's a character from Wagon Train.
Oh, I didn't realize so that. That's genius.
That's a good reference back to Trek's origins. So I like that. But at the same time, I don't think the writers are necessarily pushing that enough because MacReady and Bennings, or the sheriff and the deputy.
Yeah.
Those are names from The Thing. So that's not a Western. You like to reference things that you like, but doesn't gel into a proper Western episode, I think. I mean, it's good, but it also, I think it strays from the point, despite the director's insistence that it look like a real Western. I think the director and the writers are at odds in a way.
I now am wondering whether in story, Wagon Train, like every character was abducted by aliens after the series ended.
Headcanon. I don't know how Wagon Train ends. Did they actually end, like in 1965, did they actually found a town somewhere?
I don't know. That's a good question.
Did they have a proper finale? I don't know.
I always imagined that it was probably like one of those comic books that gets canceled on short notice and, you know, it ends in the middle of the story,
right.
But
we don't know. Okay. Well, if you know, leave it in the comments. If you were watching TV in from 57 to 65, or I assume reruns. So what does this tell us about Trek? If anything new.
The other reference to North Star that I will make is the moral compass that's displayed here.
Oh, yeah.
And that's very much a Trek thing. And it's interesting that you're seeing it in Enterprise, which is so early in the Trek timeline that it's, you know, it's basically us almost. And again, I was just super impressed at how Archer and his crew handled this. And you don't really see much of Archer and his crew. You see Archer, but he's just doing the good guy thing. You don't get much insight into his character. You see Trip and T'Pol, but you don't get much insight into them. They're just doing their job other than, you know, seeing T'Pol try to kind of trip over casual English Western language. The whole thing's kind of a procedural, but that's okay because it's a really good procedural. Sorry, back to my original point. They just threaded that needle because it could have gone. There could have been a massacre of the Skagarans. There could have been paranoia and panic and some kind of violent reaction against these people who say they're from Earth. Your first reaction is that sounds like a horrible trick. Probably those Skagarans coming back to trick us and get us back into being their slaves. And there was some violence at the end. And you're right, it wasn't grade A violence, but they handled that pretty well. They didn't. There were a lot of people standing around in places where they would have gotten shot. I would have liked to have seen them diving for cover. Maybe seeing them dive for cover is not very Trek either.
For me, this is nothing. It's not saying much that's new. I think one of the problems, like, why use a Western? And they use a Western because it was available and because the producer said, let's do a Western, because the original idea as pitched was going to be the Middle Ages.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's harder to do.
More expensive.
Yeah, more expensive. And maybe just in terms of what people would like to see, I don't know. And then it's more believable that you would stunt culture, you know, for, let's say, 300 years than it is if you would say, oh, they're still at the Middle Ages level after 1500 years. That's less believable. Those may have been factors, but it also means that there was a version of this script, but was Middle Ages instead of Westerns. You know, I know it evolved from there, but it also means that we kind of lose the reason why this story has to be told within a Western. Because I don't find that the West, like Western tropes, yes, there was prejudice and racism in that time, obviously. And some movies, especially later Westerns, do use that to some effect. Django Unchained being possibly the most popular. There's a, now we'll show what the African-American experience was, what the Asian-American experience was in the Old West, because, you know, that's where we are, where we're looking at these old tropes, but from different new perspectives. I don't find that a lot of Westerns are about this. They're not about the lawman comes in and he finds his prejudice and he tries to teach the town not to be prejudiced. That's a very Trek thing, but it's not a Western thing. So
Blazing Saddles.
Yeah. The main point is essentially that we contrast this old frontier with forging ahead a new frontier with supposedly a different attitude. And we didn't, obviously, we weren't going to be watching an entire season, but this is like a change of pace episode within the Zindi season, which is all one big arc that sometimes has like these little stories fit into it just for a break. And it's like humanity is going to get revenge on these aliens who essentially 9/11 them. Within that context, Archer is bringing the new attitude to this, but at the same time, he's on a violent mission. He's not necessarily revealing that to these people. It's like, oh, we've moved beyond these things, and yet, you know, I'm bringing a ship to an alien planet.
The Cooper Smith piece of it, the part where we react violently against these people who did us wrong, like, we're still going to do that. Mm-hmm. We're just going to skip the, you know, 200 years of racism afterwards.
Well, we haven't seen a lot of Zindi in the other shows. So that's just to say that within the context of the season, this may bring a little more.
Yeah.
This may be a, hey, Archer, you're condemning people for something that you are now doing, or for something that your descendants may end up doing as a result of your actions. It's just realizing it now that within the Zindi season, this may play differently.
So one thing that occurred to me, like probably an hour before the podcast, not when I first watched it again, but they have everything that you need to make an Old West town. And maybe Old West was easier to plausibly recreate on a planet in the middle of nowhere. And I know this isn't the only town. They said there are 6,000 of these people scattered in settlements across a space of some kilometers. I can't remember. And you probably wouldn't be able to recreate a Middle Ages town that was, you know, connected to everything and wasn't out on the edge of a frontier. But even what they do with the Old West is, to me, implausible. I mean, they had glass and different kinds of metal and paint and clothing dye and all these things that if you grabbed 6,000 random people from the American West, you would get multiple blacksmiths, you would get multiple farmers and butchers, but you wouldn't necessarily get a hattier who could make a really good felt Stetson, you know?
Those Kagarans love their hats. I don't know how many people they grabbed. You know, this is just like 200 years later, this is how many people. And
yeah,
from what we see, it's only white people. So again, the Old West was much more diverse than that as well. So
that raises another question. Did they basically just segregate? Is there a black town somewhere? Is there a Mexican-American town somewhere?
And there may be. You just don't see it. And that's not explored in the episode, unfortunately.
Yeah. Oh.
So that's North Star. I want to give Enterprise some love. People don't talk about it a lot, and it's kind of the forgotten one, but I think it has a lot of great qualities. But in terms of making this like a potent Western episode, Spectre of the Gun remains the best that we covered today.
Yeah, I agree. And I didn't dislike North Star, but the difference, if you think about the visuals in Spectre of the Gun and the visuals, especially, you know, the washed out lighting and everything that you talked about in North Star, those are two opposite ends of the spectrum, and it's
of their time, right? So
yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. It makes sense, of their time. So TNG is perhaps the one that is more the spoof and going for the Lone Ranger tropes type stuff, because Westerns weren't much of a thing in the 80s.
Yeah.
You know, or early 90s. So it's like they're not really doing Westerns of their era. They're doing what people remember of Westerns generally, whereas Spectre of the Gun is very much based on the Westerns of its day, the 50s and 60s. And then Enterprise is doing the Western as we know it in the 2000s.
So the audience is different, too, that occurs to me now as you say this. When Spectre of the Gun came out, they were presenting this show to an audience that were connoisseurs of Westerns.
Right.
You know, and it's like you said, when TNG was on, the Western was just something people used to watch.
Right. So, and that affects how much focus there is, what the twists and turns are, what is accepted as, oh, I recognize this,
yeah.
You know, as opposed to not. So, yeah, I think that's a good place to leave it. People have different thoughts, caught different references. They have a comment section they can go to at fireandwaterpodcast.com and fill us in, you know, fill in the blanks that we purposefully left so that you would comment.
Right. Let's go with that.
Yes, it's marketing. Captain Entropy, anything you want to...
I have no projects to pimp. I appreciate it. I will be back, you know, God willing, and, you know, no car accidents or whatever.
Dark.
Back in the... Yeah, I know. I will be back in the comments section. I will be hopefully back on these podcasts, but I'm not out there on a regular platform myself yet.
Well, keep an eye out for further guest appearances.
Think of me as a mysterious stranger.
I will. Especially as you are named Captain Entropy, which is mysterious in and of itself. So thanks again, Captain.
Thank you, Siskoid.
Yeah, I believe it's last call at the saloon. So I'll let you go back to the bar while I stick around for Subspace Transmissions, which is your feedback on our previous episode.
Afternoon, everybody.
Ryan!
How's that baby treating you, Mr. Daly?
Like Thanos snapping his fingers at my bank account.
In that case, how about a beer on the house?
Sure. Gotta give my mouth something to do between podcasts.
Say, Ryan, I don't get how you have so much time for podcasting. Doesn't your wife want you spending time with the baby?
Would you? Truth is, I think she's a little worried about how much time I'm spending with the kid, ever since his first words were Dagobah system. Now she wants me to go out and do something mature, something productive, and most of all, something lucrative that can support the family.
So you're going to...
Podcast about Cheers, yeah. That kid's not going to start college for 18 years. I got time. Cheerscast, the podcast where everybody knows your name. Coming soon to the Fire and Water Network.
Incoming Subspace Transmissions, your feedback on our previous episode in which my guest and I, Ryan Blake, discussed the Orions, all the ins and outs of this alien culture. A few comments here. Paul Kien says, excellent episode. The thought of the adaptable Orions had never occurred to me, but does fit a lot of the filmed canon. Cool. I liked the twists in Enterprise back in the day, and by the 30th century, who knows how they or any of the traditional alien races are organized. Overall, very thoughtful, provoking episode. P.S. Agree that Tendi and Rutherford could use a little more personality, fleshing out, but love Lower Decks. DC Dave says, fantastic episode, loved the discussion, and gave me some good things to chew on as it relates to the Orions. Fresh perspectives for me. I appreciate the knowledge gaps being filled, especially with Beta Canon stuff. The discussion about Tendi and her own profit motivations and adaptability, things I wouldn't have considered in a million years, but makes so much sense. And let's end on Gene Hendricks. He says, we use the Orions as some of the villains in Tales of the Seventh Fleet, which is a fan-produced series. Ed Tunis, the captain, found an artist, John Bridges, who did a drawing of an Orion pirate for the TNG RPG, who gave us then permission to base the costumes on. We even had them only speak in their own language with just subtitles, because why would they speak English to each other? And you can see one of those episodes in video form in the comment section for episode 62. The Fire and Water Podcast Network has a patron page at patreon.com/FW Podcast. If you like this content, want more like it, think about leaving a one-time or a monthly donation. It even unlocks rewards. For example, for $5 a month, you could get yourself on the Starfleet Commendations list, like the Q Continuum's own Doug Van Diver. Join Doug and I in the fleet at patreon.com. As usual, let me remind you that you too can leave comments at fireandwaterpodcast.com, on the Fire and Water Facebook page, on Twitter, where we are FW Podcasts. Until the next episode, this is Siskoid reminding you to go boldly.